Welcome back to the Atlanta Podcast. I am your host, Mappy Davis, and it is dun-dun-dun-dun, Boxing Day, December 26th, where you are getting a new episode, as we promised you, and you'll bring one every bloody Tuesday. Going to have some additional content for you as well on some other days, but guaranteed minimum every Tuesday. I'll be letting you know about extra content and Instagram stuff and all kinds of stuff in the future. Getting all this stuff up and rolling. But in the meantime, want to bring you cool content every week. It's Tuesday. I'm in the offices of Alkaloid, where I have some office space, which I've spoken about before, where I do many of these interviews. It's gorgeous. Nobody's here right now. I sound a little stuffed up because I am some sort of weird allergy thing. I don't know what it is. But let's get today's show, which is Michael Dunaway. Now, as you've read about, if you've read the little intro, Michael came to my attention because he made a documentary called 21 Years Richard Linklater. And it's a documentary where he finds phenomenal actors that have worked with Richard Linklater over the years, and they made this cool documentary out of it. If you have not seen it, it's that guy and the other guy and that other girl. I'm so sorry, guys. Matthew McConaughey, Ethan Hawke. Those are the two hugest names that I can think of off the top of my head, but the list does, in fact, go on and on. Go Google that movie. Go watch that movie. We talk about it a little. But he's a great dude. He's a great dude who I met, as you'll hear, 2 years prior to this. And this is the episode that you're getting with him. Sorry. Sentences not working, syntax, my brain not firing, not going to start over. Who cares? Love you guys. So yeah, Michael and I had a nice chat right here not that many weeks ago. And again, I'm not, if you listen to the show, I'm not one to list five things we talked about on the show notes and then say those again at the beginning of the episode just for you to hear them. I like you to just enjoy them. So without further ado, Michael and I, away we go. Okay, so I'm going to tell the whole story, dude. So 2+ years ago,
yes,
we sat in your living room.
Indeed.
And shortly before your dog passed away.
Indeed.
And
indeed.
I'm sorry to bring up a sore spot, but it's just for timing purposes.
Bishop, R.I.P.
R.I.P. I still got a picture of him in your couch, which we probably will include in this episode. But I had started a documentary podcast.
Yes.
Which I never even aired yours because I was too embarrassed. The sound was a little too wacky. I put a tape recorder in the middle of the room.
Gotcha.
And there was too much echo in your house.
Gotcha. Lots of concrete and glass.
Lots of concrete and glass. And since then, that podcast sort of died a natural death, as most podcasts do.
Exactly.
Including your old one. But this one is sticking. This is the Atlanta podcast, where I talk to people in Atlanta I think are interesting and somewhat famous in this case, right?
Famous adjacent. Maybe.
Are you Atlanta famous? That's another thing.
Yeah,
we do.
There you go.
So that was Jake from Jake's Ice Cream, by the way.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So he's Atlanta famous. He's amazing. No that guy. Doubt. Amazing that guy.
I've never met him, but I've had his work, tasted his work.
Well, not only have you had his work, but he has started a kitchen incubator.
Oh wow!
And out of that kitchen incubator came, the first place he gave space to was the Little Tart, which is now has a couple locations.
Fantastic. Little Tart Bake Shop, yep.
King of Pops.
Ugh.
Right?
Better than King of Pops.
And then there was one more that he's a very giving, cool guy. But anyway, so you and I, so we might go over some of the same things that we went over way back then.
Absolutely.
And we might cover some new ground. And, you know, it's the Atlanta podcast, but sometimes we go deep Atlanta weeds and sometimes we don't. Sometimes like you and I could end up talking about the 95 Braves for an hour, and that's cool with me too. It's much more Marin style than
just see where it goes.
Exactly.
I got you.
Exactly. So first of all, it is good to see you.
It's great to see you. It's been a while.
Right. And you've had these wonderful parties that I've never been able to make, and I appreciate being invited. And you're having one again that I can't make.
Next week. You can't make the one next week.
I totally want to come. I'm going to Iceland, believe it or not.
Oh, fantastic.
For my other career, which is the obstacle racing stuff.
Well, that's a good enough excuse. I mean,
I know, but I want to make one of your things, and I do. I totally appreciate. So by the way, are you still in that house?
No. We're in a new house now. Not a new house. We're in a different house now. About a year and a half, a little over a year and a half ago, we moved for the people listening who might not know. We built a sort of California modern concrete and glass house in south of East Atlanta Village, that we lived in for about 7 years. But then about a year and a half ago, we moved into Avondale Estates, which is just outside Decatur. I don't know if you know the area or not.
I know Avondale Estates-ish.
It was actually the first planned suburb in Georgia, and I have heard it was actually the first planned suburb in America.
What about whatchamacallit though?
Whatchamacallit?
Right here.
What about whatchamacallit right here? What do
you, you know that movie with that guy? Remember that thing?
You know, the guy and with the girl too.
So whatchamacallit is the first neighborhood, they said. They always say that.
Oh really?
Right here.
Okay. All right.
What's it called? Not Grant Park, not Old Fourth Ward, but
Cabbage Town.
Not Cabbage Town. It's literally
Inman Park.
Inman Park is supposedly the first Atlanta neighborhood.
Well, this when I say I'm talking about a like built outside Atlanta as a place as a sort of country community at that point.
Right.
You know. Avondale Estates was way far out.
Right. So even though it's probably what, like 8-12 miles, it felt like
it's within the perimeter. You know, it's literally the next thing you get to after Decatur.
Okay.
As you're going out Ponce de Leon, which then become well, as you're going out College Avenue.
Right. Okay. And what just you just wanted more space, less space.
Yeah, as our kids got older, I always say the house that we built was perfect for when we built it because we had a 2-year-old and a newborn, and we both worked outside the home, and we worked with a wonderful local architect, Emery Leonard, who is one of my my wife's college friends. And we designed exactly the house that would work for us we wanted to have a small footprint and have just as much space as we needed and no more and that kind of thing.
Right.
We have similar tastes in architecture, this sort of, as I say, California modern, concrete and glass, that kind of thing. And it was perfect for when we moved into it. So then you fast forward 7 years later. Now we've got a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old.
Uh-huh.
Very loud.
Yep.
Right? And both my wife and I at this point work in the home.
Okay.
And at that point, it was exactly the wrong house for us. And so we had to move. But then it sort of coincided with us starting to spend a little bit of time with our friends Nick and Jen Purdy, who had moved to Avondale Estates not long before we moved into our house. And we really fell in love with the neighborhood of Avondale Estates. Well, I like to call it Avondale because Estates makes it sound like some, you know, Country Club of the South type thing or something. Not that I have anything against Country Club of the South, but no, Avondale, I always say it's...
That's where all those guys live, by the way.
In Country Club of the South, exactly.
All those Braves pitchers. At least they used to. Are they all still around?
I don't know who's still around, who's not. I think Smoltz is still around.
Right, Smoltz
still does TBS stuff a lot.
Right. We should get him on the show.
Yeah, oh, that'd be great.
Smoltzy.
He'd be amazing. But we really fell in love with Avondale. It's kind of this, I describe it as Mayberry inside the perimeter.
Right.
It's one of the few neighborhoods in not only Atlanta, but any big city that I've been to that really, truly, like a lot of communities try to sell, it's a neighborhood feel, but it's in the city.
Right.
Avondale feels almost in a Stepford Wives way. It feels very insular, very everybody knows everybody. For the first 3 or 4 months that we lived there, the cop that was always, I mean, you know, we're our own city, right? So we have our one cop car, right? And the cop would always like sort of, as when we drove by, would always kind of look, sometimes follow us down the street, whatever, like, I don't know this car, what's going on, you know? And then after 3 months or so, never happened again because he realized, they live here now,
right?
You know? And you know, you see people actually walking their dogs and kids riding their bikes. And it's a very old tree neighborhood, which my wife and I have a theory that old trees are one of the keys to having this really safe and comfortable feeling neighborhood.
I think that's an interesting theory because if they've chopped them down, it means that it's new.
Yeah, there's some. I think, you know, I have to give her credit. It was my wife who first suggested this to me, and then I put my own twist on it. But I think that there's that there's something about the trees that were there already being not only their size and their sort of their ancient is a not exactly the right word, but that their fixedness,
right,
and somewhat also their randomness. The tree was where the universe wanted the tree. It wasn't where you decided the tree should be.
Right.
And I think there's something deep inside us that responds to that. Or I should say, maybe it's stronger the opposite, that when we encounter an environment that is too planned, especially a natural environment that's too planned, I at least have, there's a nagging unease in the back of my mind. Like, this doesn't feel... I don't know.
Well, I would say, speaking of the Braves, that was my horrible experience at the new stadium.
Oh, gosh.
So I wanted to be open-minded. Somebody gave me tickets. My friend Charlie, who's probably listening, gave me tickets to the Braves stadium. And I thought, okay, I'm probably going to hate this place, but let me have an open mind.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to take my son there and appreciate it. So I drive into this fucking mall parking lot, right? It's like, okay, strike one.
Right.
Like, this is not, no one's going to be tailgating in this parking lot ever.
Right.
And then I walk into, it looks like the Grove in LA. It's an outdoor mall.
Yeah.
And I get to the park. Now, here's what it had going against it. It was like the last home game of the season. We're not in the pennant race. It was the middle of the day. It was super hot.
Yeah.
So the stakes were super low and it just kind of sucked for that reason. But all those reasons combined was like, yeah, I can't see myself. And it was a bummer because I wanted my son to have like a decent experience for his first ball game. But I'll take him some time, you know, when a game means something, or maybe a night game or something. But yeah, I mean, oh, and the Coke and hot dog, you know, $30, whatever the fuck it was. It was just not a good experience.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you take it from a sort of natural or faux natural environment to a completely man-made environment, because I do have the same reaction to new developments that spring up, even when they're done really, really well. I think it's really difficult to simulate what traditionally in a neighborhood has happened over decades of relatively organic growth and businesses rising and falling and different people buying different pieces of land and putting different things on that. And there's just something that and I don't want to name any names, because I have a couple of friends who have designed some of the bigger planned environments in Atlanta. But and it's not that I don't respect the work that they do, because among those kinds of things, their ones are the best that I can imagine. I mean,
right.
but it's just not my thing. It's not my jam, baby.
I so wonder what's going to happen. You know, all these condos going on.
Sure.
You know, everywhere you look on the Beltline, especially. Everywhere is just more condos.
Yeah, yeah.
And what happens over time to that area?
Yeah.
Like, are they just going to tear them down and build newer condos? Or what will happen? You know, we've got this very, you know, very happening, walkable, neighborhoody thing that they're doing in town, and people are on their bikes and pushing strollers and whatever. And will it, you know, is it going to stick around? Like, that's the gazillion-dollar question, right?
Yeah.
So I live in the West End now, which is very underdeveloped, and I don't know if it's going to, like, people are investing like it's going to pop like this side, but I don't know.
And, you know, I'm not the city, my wife is literally the master of city plan, has a master's degree in city planning, so she's the city planner of our family, but it is a topic that I've thought about a lot and read about, and you know, I think there's a danger of over-romanticizing, and, you know, Peggy Noonan, whose writing I really love, I really think she's a fantastic writer, but someone who was criticizing her writing once said, dismissingly said that her writing was ice cream cones were bigger than writing. And I do think there's a little bit of danger of slipping into ice cream cones were bigger than about the sort of neighborhood you grew up in. I grew up in Macon, Georgia,
in an
older neighborhood, you know, and absolutely loved it. Loved the feeling of the neighborhood, you know. But that certainly is a relatively recent phenomenon, the kind of neighborhood, ideal neighborhood we're talking about, right? And I don't know. It has, like you say about podcasts, it probably has a natural life cycle that won't always We don't always want to be the norm, you know?
Did you listen to a lot of Allman Bros back in the day?
I was a huge Allman Brothers fan from early on. It was inescapable. You know, I was born in 68, so, you know, I grew up in the 70s in Macon, and you know, when they were actually in their absolute heyday, I was a little bit young, obviously,
right.
with Dwayne dying in the early 70s. But yeah, no, they were a huge their music and the music of Otis Redding, who also is from Macon, huge influence and hugely ever present. And actually, it's funny you ask that, because I have a piece, an essay that I'm writing about Greg Allman, having, you know,
in Pace magazine
this year. Don't know if it's going to be for Pace or not. We'll see. We'll see where the best fit for it is. I transitioned this year
into a woman.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm sorry.
I think anyone who knows me well knows that I'm a transgender lesbian. No, I don't mean to make light of anyone's journey in that way. Obviously, just trying to anyway. Self-regulate is probably a good thing for me to do right about now before I get myself into any more trouble. But no, I had been, as you know, I had been the movies editor for 7 years. I've been the movies editor. The last couple of those years, I had been had a co-movies editor as well. And I transitioned, there we go again, earlier this year into an editor-at-large position at Paste. So I'm no longer working. It's funny, a lot of people hear editor-at-large, and I got so many emails saying, oh, congratulations, Paste is in good hands with you. I'm like, no.
It doesn't mean that.
It doesn't mean what you think it means.
Right.
It basically just means that I'm not involved in the day-to-day anymore there.
Right.
And I write for other sections besides the film section, and that I write for other magazines too. That's basically what
right.
They
think it means in chief.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Right.
So for instance, I had in January, I had really one of my favorite pieces I've ever written, and certainly the one that has gotten the strongest reaction in a good way, the best reception. I published in another Atlanta publication, The Bitter Southerner. I don't know if you know Chuck Reese or not, but
I do not.
It's an electronic publication, one article per week.
They better be good.
Exactly right. And I think he really had his finger on the pulse with this idea of this highly curated in this new environment where nearly everything in movies, in music, in writing, in art, we have access to so much, exponentially bigger universe than we ever have before. And Chuck had this, I think, brilliant idea to say, hey, what if we took curation to an extreme and said, here's one article that you need to see this week.
Right. I like it. I like it.
Yeah. And he also had I don't know, this podcast is not about Chuck, but I will say that Chuck also had a really brilliant take on sort of the overarching theme of the magazine. It's really about the Southern experience, but there's also as you might expect from the name, there's also an element of sort of sifting through our legacy as Southerners and our birthright as Southerners. And as my grandmother's pastor used to say, chewing up the meat and spitting out the bones. So there's a lot of you know, sort of dealing with issues of race and dealing with the past in some kind of compassionate way while still being proud to be from where we're from.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, like you in the content business.
Yeah.
And so in many ways it is about like just keep cranking it out. And if this article isn't great, here comes another one. Or if this podcast isn't great, here comes another one. But I can totally, like, I wouldn't ever approach it that way, I don't think, but I can really respect and want to see, like, oh, if they're putting out one article a week, they're probably killing it.
Yeah.
Because
they
got to make sure that it's on point.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's funny. What I'm writing about Greg, one of the things I'm writing about Greg is that I was too young, and I might be wrong. I might be wrong about this cultural shift, but it seems to me I need to do a little more research to make sure that my subjective experience matched up with the object. But it seems to me that in the late 60s, early 70s, American culture went through a little bit of a fascination with Southern culture, even through the mid 70s, where Southern culture was cool, right? And it was, the, you know, blue jeans and the long beard and a Southern accent, and it was seen as authentic, you know, mid to late 60s, this obsession with authenticity, you know? And then it seems like somewhere around the mid to, or somewhere around the late 70s, it sort of, the cycle turned a little bit, and it became a little bit of parodying the South, right?
Right.
So even though Burt Reynolds was really cool and everybody thought he was amazing, right? There was still, by the time, you know, it's the difference between Deliverance and Smokey and the Bandit, and I don't know off the top of my head the years of release of those two. But Deliverance, you see Burt Reynolds is a, and they're different genres of movies, obviously, right? But in Deliverance, he is a brawny, sexy, elemental force in that, in the Southern, a Southern man in that movie, right? Smokey and the Bandit, he's, and again, it's a comedy, it's lighthearted, whatever, but he's also, he's still sexy, he's still cool, but there's a little bit of a ha ha ha, what a dumb redneck kind of thing to not only his, especially all the other characters around
him. Right. Well, late 70s, early 80s was also glam punk, right?
True.
Like all that's happening, which is the opposite. Which is the opposite, right?
But what's so in this environment? I'm sorry, I'm taking a long time to get to the point.
No, it's fine.
I'll get to the point earlier. But
that's why I'm saying they thought the South was a joke, because now it's about being cool with glam and punk and all these new.
Yes, exactly. But through that all, Greg, I posit that Greg Allman was the exception. Greg Allman was never not the coolest guy in the room.
Right.
Not only not cool, but the coolest guy in the room. And he also, as an interesting, you know, aside, the Allman Brothers Band was the first big band that I can think of besides the Jimi Hendrix Experience that was integrated. There was black and white, you know, J-Mo, one black guy and a bunch of white guys playing together. And they were all brothers. And they called themselves the Allman Brothers. And they would all tell you, that's not just Greg and Dwayne. That's everyone in the band is a brother, you know. Barry Oakley's grave in Macon, in Rose Hill Cemetery in Macon, says a brother, you know.
Is J-Mo still with us?
J-Mo is still with us, yeah. J-Mo's still with us. And J-Mo and oh my gosh, of course, Dickie Betts. J-Mo, right. Dickie Betts, Dickie. The only two left.
Yeah, I've seen the Allman Bros a few times. Those classic Lakewood shows, just fucking smoke a fatty and lay in the grass, and
absolutely.
But interestingly enough about Southern music is that I've have you seen the Drivin' and Cryin' documentary?
I have not, you know, I met the guy who made that documentary.
Von Hessler?
Yes, and he gave me a copy of it. And dude, if you're listening to this, I'm sorry. I have not watched it yet.
So listen.
But I will.
So it's on Amazon if you've got Prime.
Yeah.
That's how I watched it. And so I'm a little bit younger than you.
Yeah.
So for me... Like, I grew up in that sweet spot of REM and Drivin' and Cryin', right? Mm-hmm. And to me, it wasn't even Southern rock. It was fucking music.
It was just rock.
Right? It was music.
Yeah.
But because of that, because of watching that documentary, I've gone back and bought on iTunes, because I sold all my records and CDs years ago. I bought Drivin' and Cryin' on iTunes. I bought REM on iTunes. And again, we all know, like, they were U2 size at one point.
Sure.
But going back to listening to their, like, earlier stuff, and, like, this, like, they did create this, like, Southern jangle sound. Like, it's so good.
Yep.
And
absolutely.
I feel stupid saying, because it's like saying, well, duh, Beethoven's good. But do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, and people like that in that generation, people like Greg in the earlier generation, it went beyond the music, too. It went to persona.
Right.
It was, you know, I think Greg presented a way to be proud to be Southern,
right,
when most elements of Southern culture were being ridiculed. And I also, I've got to in saying all that, I've got to shout out my parents and
always encourage the parents
and encourage all other parents to do what they did, which was very, very early on. So I was a break, bringing that back to the Braves. I was a Braves fan very early on. And would always borrow my father's little transistor radio to listen to the Braves game. Mm-hmm. And so once I started doing that all the time, that next birthday or Christmas or whatever it was, they gave me my own transistor radio. And it was only AM, but I, of course, started listening to that not only for the Braves games, but then, you know, AM 940 WMAZ, big AM station in Macon, and started. That was how I discovered music, through that sort of 70s AM rock, and they saw how much it meant to me. They saw how much I was walking around all, because it was this big,
you know, right?
This big, I'm for those of you listening, this is bad radio, but I'm holding up something that's probably 1.5 times the size of a cigarette pack,
right?
You know, and so they encouraged that, and they said, hey, we have all these albums. Why don't you listen to this Simon and Garfunkel? Why don't you listen to the Beatles? Why don't you listen to, you know, West Side Story? And then every step along the way encouraged my musical journey. And I owe so much to my parents there. I can't imagine better parents.
I'm always really jealous when people say that. I did not have that experience, but please continue.
Well, one of the things they did the best, among the many things they did well, is really encouraging not only music, but whatever passions I was showing a commitment to, they were all for it, and they were very supportive, and they were just fantastic in that way. And so that, I think that even though it took me a while to come around to being an artist full time, I know that the seeds were sown by that upbringing by my parents, in addition to a couple of people in my teenager and early 20s dumb that sort of encouraged me to think of myself that way. So,
all right, well, let's talk about movies, since we've talked about music a lot.
Sure.
What do you remember some of your first like cinema experiences?
So this is one I love this answer to this, because it's an answer you hardly ever get from anybody. And actually, speaking of growing up in Macon, there's a tie there too. You know, I always talk about how you know, I grew up in a relatively small southern town in the 70s. You know, I was born in 68. I was born the year that Martin Luther King was assassinated, right? So, and you would expect that someone growing up from the early 70s on in a smaller southern town would encounter a lot of racism and closed-mindedness, and would be seen as, and would have a lot of that influence. But what's interesting about my upbringing is my dad taught at Mercy, still does teach at Mercy University in Macon. So it's kind of like living in Austin, where they describe it as an island of blue in a sea of red,
right?
So I was able to get, I think, a lot of the good things about growing up in a small southern town in the 70s. But then, you know, my dad's friends were intellectuals. They were civil rights heroes. They were, you know, researchers into the human condition, right? And then, in addition, my dad was and is a very active part of the larger life of the university, activities and events and such. And so he would take us to plays and orchestral performances and choral performances and whatever, right? So now I'm getting to the point. So my dad is a French professor, and so one of the things that he would do is he would take me a lot to when the Department of Modern Foreign Languages, it was all combined into one at that point, still is actually, when they did screenings, he would take me to the screenings. And thank goodness he didn't think about, oh, are these movies appropriate to to this kid? Because I was able very early on to see some really great movies that really influenced me. Really great, specifically really great foreign movies, and often French movies. And one of the earliest ones I remember is a movie called The Battle of Algiers. And man, going back and seeing it today, I'm like, there is no way that I would take my 6-year old to see this movie, you know? So, I think that early on it was all tied up with this idea of, of going with my father, who's my greatest hero, and being with all the college kids and watching these really sophisticated movies. I think it was, you know, I love Star Wars like everybody did. I love Jaws like everybody did. But that felt a little bit more like just part of being a kid going to those movies.
Right.
But going to see these movies really, I think, broadened my view of what there's no way I would have put it this way at the time, but what the medium could accomplish. Looking back on it, that's
right.
What my little brain was starting to go, oh, wow, things can be weird and ambiguous and disturbing. And yeah.
And did you know, like, what age did you know, like, okay, I definitely want to pursue, I'm not going to be a guy that sits at a desk, I'm going to pursue the arts?
I don't know how to make this a short answer. I'll make this as short an answer.
It's a podcast, dude. You got nothing but time. Okay. Totally cool.
So, you know, I'm not one of these people that, you know, knew from the time they were 5 years old exactly what they wanted to do. That's not me. I wish I had that romantic story to tell. I do know that I always loved movies. I do know that once I started acting, I really enjoyed acting, right? And then especially in high school and college, that really started to become one of the most important things to me. But also, I grew up lower middle class in a small southern town. And when I went to college, you know, at one point, I went to my parents. I said, I think I want to be a theater major. And my parents, you know, to their great credit, said, why don't you do theater in college and major in something that might help you get a job, you know? Which is an unromantic notion, but I think a very practical notion.
Is that what you would tell your kids?
I don't know. Part of it is that the world is so different now. Understand that. You know, when I graduated from college in 1991, right? And in 1991, really the only way to get into film would be to move to Los Angeles and start working free jobs if you could get them, as a free PA and try to wait tables or something like that. And that was just not a realistic for someone who can't call home and say, Mom and Dad, I need, you know, $800 for rent this month.
Right.
That just was not a realistic possibility.
I think it was much cheaper then, but okay.
Yeah, true.
Like
true.
When I was in LA, I think I paid $350 at one point for something, but anyway.
But it's, I always say that the, you know, filmmakers, painters, writers, pop musicians, we all have a huge advantage with regard to our passion, which is that it doesn't have to be what we do all day, every day. You can do it after you get home from work and on the weekends. Now, if you're passionate about heart surgery, you can't do that outside your job, right? If you're passionate about architecture, I guess you could do architecture, but not in any in the way you want to do it. You couldn't do that at nights and on the weekends, you know. But you know, if you're going to be a surgeon and you go to and if you want to be your biggest dream is to be a surgeon, and you go to college, you're going to have to major in biology or some kind of pre-med, right? But you know, acting, directing is something that you can absolutely do while you're majoring in something else. As it happens, I ended up majoring in English, which I think actually helped. Has helped me a lot more as an artist than a theater degree would have, because it grounded me in story and it grounded me in character and it grounded me in a different kind of rigor in analyzing those things. And then, I mean, the theater department at Swanee where I went is a wonderful department. And I also think that doing theater, I picked up a large percentage of what I would have picked up as a theater major. Now, Pete Smith, the chairman of the department when I was there and still there now, is probably pounding the table right now and saying, shut up, Michael. Don't discourage people from majoring in theater. And I would never do that, but yeah.
Well, I mean, it is a very different world. I mean, I think I came from that last generation of you must go to college to get a degree and you must. And I'm sure there's plenty of parents, by the way, that are still saying that.
Sure.
And I've just never believed that. And now more than ever, don't believe that. So anyway, we'll see what happens as my kids get older and do whatever the heck it is that they're going to end up doing.
Yeah.
But did you, so what was like your first like job outside of college?
So I again, I have a very unusual career path for a filmmaker or for anyone really. But first job out of college, I was a high school teacher, high school English teacher. Also
in Atlanta or Macon? Or
started out in New Orleans and then went to Macon, a total of 3 years, English, and did the drama program and coached soccer at both places. The 2 years in Macon, I actually taught at my alma mater that I had gone to, which was really not Mount DeSales Academy, go Cavaliers, which I'm still passionate about and still involved with, and alumni things, that kind of thing. I then went back to graduate school, and went to business school, to Cornell's MBA program up in upstate New York, and I was in the financial world for I think 7 years total. And then 9/11 happened, and I had sort of painted myself into a corner of doing a very specific thing in the financial world, and I was working for a medium-sized company, and when 9/11 happened, a lot of the financial firms were rocked, right? And I was laid off because they were like, no, this thing that we're doing over here, that can wait. We got to cut as much salary as we can. But then also, of course, a lot of other firms were doing that, so there weren't a lot of jobs doing what I had been doing.
How were you getting your artistic fix during that time?
That's a good question. So during that time, I was involved on nights and weekends in some theatrical productions. And I was writing for some online magazines at that point. That's later in that. Now, it is interesting. When I went back to graduate school, I was torn between going to graduate school for directing or for business. But again, practical matters came in because graduate school is really expensive. Then what are you going to do after that? I was 94 at that point. Same thing. You're going to have to go and work for nothing in LA, right. But it was definitely, socially, I was definitely involving myself with as many artists and musicians and not so much filmmakers at that point, but stage actors and directors and stuff. But it was definitely
a lot of like dirty hippies and sex.
Exactly. But it was, that itch was definitely not getting scratched as much as it needed to be. Right. So then after 9/11, I had a year where I was basically un or underemployed, and then I completely randomly got into academic publishing in sales, and did that for I think 6 years, part of which overlapped my time as a filmmaker.
So you sold academic books?
Right. I went to, basically I had a geographic territory, and we were a political science publisher primarily. So I'd go and I would visit the political science department at various universities, and I would sell the professors on using our books, assigning our books as their in their next semester's classes. And we were the premier publisher in political science, so it wasn't like I was walking and saying, "Hey, I know you've never heard of me, but look at this great book." That would, it was it was nice to have that intro.
Do you still have to buy massive college books, or have they done away with that and it's online stuff now?
Oh, no. There's definitely, some of them are online. Some people use online books, but it's still, it's almost as expensive to buy the online books. And then
I remember it being that was more expensive than anything.
Absolutely.
The books were like $80-$90 a pop.
Absolutely.
And then you'd sell them back at the end of the year and they'd give you $30.
Well, and it has to do with it has to do with the economics, again, coming from the Cornell MBA school, right? It has to do with the economics of it. The number of Stephen King novels that's going to sell is, by a exponential rate larger than the number of, it's a very limited run of a textbook compared to a trade paperback, right?
Right.
So you have to sell it at a higher price in order to make the economics of it work. I would always say when I got into this conversation with students, because students never understood why they're so expensive, I was like, look, I'll take you out. I'll show you what I drive. I drive a 97 Toyota 4Runner.
Right.
I'll tell you what the president of the company that I work for drives, and it's not what you think.
Right.
It's a nice car, but it's not a,
Right.
And I'll tell you what the author of this book drives, and it's this. Nobody is getting rich off of you having to pay $100 for your textbook. It's just
college isn't getting rich.
No, well, the bookstore makes a percentage on it for sure. But
I bet once I'm just guessing, and you would know more than me, but I'm guessing maybe in the 50s and 60s it was pretty much at cost, and then one day the bookstore was like, well, we're the only supplier in town. So if we raise our margin, you know what I'm saying?
No. It's generally set by the publishers. There's generally a percentage markup that the bookstore has, and it's pretty comparable across bookstores. It's kind of an industry standard.
Right.
So it's just a matter of, you know, if they've got, let's say it's a 20% markup, and we come out with a book that's $100 to them, right? Then in the bookstore to the student, it's $120, standard 20% markup, yeah.
All right. Well, this is good. This is good education. Side note: we just learned in this.
But it's just the numbers. I mean, if you can imagine, to take it reductio absurdum, right? If there was a book that was going to take you 3 years to write, right, and you were only going to sell it to one person, there's only one person that was ever going to buy it,
right?
And you had to print it, and you had to bind it, and
it would
be
expensive, right?
It'll be a really expensive book because there's only one customer, right?
Right.
So these textbooks are not only one customer, but they're probably closer to one customer than they are to however many Stephen King sold of his last book.
Right. No, yeah, I have a book, and I know there's no money in it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I'm well. Have you written a book yet?
I have not.
You could. You probably are one of those situations where you could even just take like a gazillion blogs and make a book, right?
Sure.
But yeah, they're not a moneymaker. It's more a, you know, tick that box, feather in your cap. Hey, I wrote a book.
We were talking pretty seriously with UGA Press a little while ago about a sort of compilation of interviews, because I'm a photographer as well. So
I did not know.
Oh, okay. So a compilation of interviews and photographs with actors, directors, musicians, that kind of thing.
Right.
But it just never, nothing ever came of it. Their model didn't fit what Josh and I wanted to do with that book. And then we just never
Who's Josh?
Josh Jackson, who's the editor-in-chief of Paste.
Okay.
So all the 90% of these pieces that I would have been putting in this book were from Paste. And so obviously Paste has the rights to those now. So
right.
it was a project we were doing together. And the Paste name was going to be valuable to the book.
Right. So so I believe you told me last time we talked that he just asked you to start writing, and then you eventually became an editor. Is that what?
Yeah, what happened was, and actually this is something I think interesting that we could talk about, this model. When I had my big epiphany about what I should start doing, which was very much driven by my friend David Clausen, who's now my partner in Gasoline Films, he told me, you know, on the filmmaking side, I can help with that because my first thing I wanted to do was a music documentary. He works for BMI. And he's an executive at BMI. And he said, look, I can help get you these interviews. Let's form a film company. Let's start making that movie. And I said, great. And he said, now on the writing about, because I told him filmmaking and writing about films. He said, now on the writing about films side, he said, you know, I don't publish anything, but you're friends with Josh and Nick, our friends Josh Jackson and Nick Purdy, two of the three co-founders of Paste, and I've since become friends with the third, Tim Regan Porter. He said, you're friends with Josh and Nick, just send them some of your writing. And, you know, I mean, Paste was then and is now my favorite magazine in the world. So that was like, to me, that was like somebody saying, well, you know somebody at the New York Times, just send them your, you know.
Right.
And so, but he talked me into it. I did send it to them. They liked it. They had me work with their online film editor at the time, and actually at the time there was a Paste Atlanta site.
Aha.
And this was a memory of coming up to Atlanta from Macon and seeing punk shows when I was in high school, and so I started writing for the Paste Atlanta. Then from there I went to work writing for Paste Online, just Paste Magazine online.
Are you old enough to have seen that first Sex Pistols show in America?
No, unfortunately not. I was a Johnny Come Lately. I was an 80s punk guy.
Okay.
I wasn't a 70s punk guy.
Right.
You know what
show I'm talking about, right?
Oh yeah. Okay. Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah.
All right, so educate the listener really quickly.
So you're talking about the one where they came and played like two songs and then walked off stage,
right?
In New York, right?
No, I'm sorry. So when they came to America, their first actual show was here. At
oh no, I don't know this story. Oh my gosh,
what's it called? I guess it was a famous. It was called like the Atlanta. It had like a country name, I think.
Okay,
and
okay.
You know, like bottles were thrown and people weren't sure what to do with it exactly. And it right. was like a famous, it was like their literally their very first show in America.
Wow.
I can't believe you don't know this.
Wow. No, I don't know that.
We'll Google it later.
My next door neighbor when I was growing up had this great story about how at her senior, I forget if it was the mother or the father, but one of their, they went to their senior prom and there's this weird, weird sort of, it was in the 60s, early 60s, and this weird sort of, what would they, we would now describe as psychedelic band, and the lead singer was drunk and kind of falling all over the stage, and everybody just hated it.
Thought, and it was the Doors?
And it was the Doors. Yeah.
Right, so by the way, if you're listening to this and you know what I'm talking about, drop me a note on Facebook or send me an email. Anyhow.
Get it in the show notes, right?
We'll get it in the show notes.
So then I started writing for both for the online and for the print magazine, right? And then Paste had a big, if you remember the Save Paste campaign, Paste had a big sort of crisis where the financial model just wasn't working. And Paste ended up declaring bankruptcy, laying off a whole bunch of people, being sold, being reborn, right? So in the midst of all of that, the film, the two very unfortunate things for Paste, but fortunate things for me happened, which were that Paste couldn't pay the film editor, movies editor, so they had to lay him off or let him go, right? But then they still needed film coverage.
So you edited it.
And I had a day job. So I approached Nick and Josh, and I said, look, I know I've only been writing for about a year and a half for Paste, but you know me, you know my taste, you know that I'm a good writer, you know that I have a good network, and I'll work for free. Would you consider having me as the movies editor? And they agreed. I was the acting movies editor for about 3 months, and then they said, "Dude, you're killing it. Forget acting. You're the movies editor now." So, but this is something I really feel strongly about in for creative pursuits, is that especially now in this new world, there are so many people that want to be doing these things, that if you can figure out a way to make it work, to work for free,
absolutely,
to show your worth, it's, I don't, if you're not going to do that, you have to know somebody or be really, really lucky, because you're probably, the odds are against your work being so good that somebody's just going to fling a door open for you and say, oh my God, you're the greatest writer ever. Right. Come take a job for $80,000 a year being right. our staff movie reviewer. It's just not going to happen. The economics of it just don't work. And sadly, for most publications, the difference between having a truly great film writer and having a really good film writer, the economics of that are not that different. And there are only a few truly great, and I'm not one of them, there are only a few truly great film writers out there, but there's a lot of really good film writers out there, and a lot of them will work for not much money. And it sucks to be on the writer's side, but that's just the economics of the situation right now.
Yeah, I think you know, people say millennials, but I don't think it's even a millennials thing. I think it's sort of the what's in the universe now is sort of this American Idol, sure, I'm going to be discovered sort of mentality that sure. people have, and there is a fine line because there are people that want you to work for nothing and probably maybe past when you should. So you got to figure out when that is for you. But I absolutely think saying to someone, listen, I'd love an opportunity to prove myself and this is what I'll do for nothing. And there's some people that are like, no, I'll never do that. You know what I mean? But there's a line in there somewhere. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And then also, you know, the other thing is you need the practice,
right?
You need the reps. You need that. You're probably not going to get the 10,000 hours that Gladwell recommends,
right,
but you need to get a few thousand hours.
Right.
And you're probably not going to get paying jobs for 10,000 hours of work
Did you see? What's his name? Mammoth's little masterclass.
No, I know what you're talking. The whole subscription masterclass thing.
Right.
I did not see his.
He said you should. I haven't watched the whole thing, obviously, but in his little preview, it's pretty funny. He says you need the practice. The only way to do that is to write a bunch of plays and perform them in front of people, and they're gonna suck, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
like that's really sadly. Or not sadly, that's how you get better at something.
The famous Beckett quote, fail again, fail better.
Right.
And then another thing that I always love to cite when I'm doing screenwriting workshops is the average number of screenplay written that a screenwriter finally sells his first one? 9.
I was going to say 10.
Yeah. So, and then my friend who I heard this from always says, it's like the Beatles said, number 9, number 9, number 9. He says, if you haven't written 9 best you can screenplays,
right,
you're not even at the average point of selling one yet.
And I forget there was somebody, it's a famous story, you might know it. I mean, it's probably happened more than once, but the one that was, that happened, where the guy comes in and like had put his whole fucking life into something and it was like, here it is. And they were like, sorry, you got anything else? And it was like, I got this little, and it turned out to be, I don't know, fucking Memento or something huge.
Wow, wow.
It wasn't Memento. I can't, if you, again, if you know what I'm talking about, let me know. But it was one of the situations where it was the other thing. It wasn't their life's work. But I also think part of it, and again, like, remember when you were young and dumb.
Yeah.
Okay. So I got to LA at 27, which isn't even that young, you know, wanted to be a stand-up comic. And I, like almost everybody else, thinks, I'm here. Right. I just got off the bus.
Time for me to be discovered.
Right? And that's that, you know, and then you do have life kick you in the ass, sure, right? And punched in the face a few times before you kind of wake up. You know what I mean?
Sure, sure.
So part of that, I'm not just blaming young people. Like, it's just how it goes.
Well, you know, with you bringing up the thing about the second idea being the one that got picked up, right, this is something. And look, part of this is luck. Part of this, absolutely, is just the, right, way my mind works. I'm, you know, creatively, I'm a little ADD, right? So I have, you know, that first conversation I had with Dave Clawson on the roof when he convinced me to try doing this thing, he said, what have you always wanted to do? I said, I've always wanted to make movies. He said, do you have an idea for a movie? I said, I've got 20 ideas for movies.
Right.
He said, okay, pitch me one, right? But that's like the story of my life as far as, I mean, I could sit down, I could probably by memory, I could probably name you 30 projects that if I had unlimited money, I would start tomorrow, right? And so what I've tried to do my entire career, which has only been 9 years, but my entire career as a creative is to develop those ideas, try to figure out which ones have a little bit of a possibility of, oh, I can see a path for that. I can see a path for that. I can see a path for that. And kind of, rather than having this one that I have to get done, kind of push everyone forward and let, again, to bring it back all the way back to the beginning, let the universe show me what it's ready for. The biggest thing that I've been involved with up to this point, which is my Linklater documentary, which was my PR person tells me I have to mention every time, was a New York Times critics pick, and starred.
Well, we were going to get to it. It's how I became aware of who you were, for sure.
You know, had Matthew McConaughey and Ethan Hawke and, you know, Jack Black and Parker Posey and Julie Delpy and Billy Bob Thornton, all these great people, Zac Efron. If you had, the day before that project came about, if you had asked me, name your 5 projects that you're most trying to push forward, it would not have been on the list of 5. It would have been on the list of 10. It was the thing. It was one of the things that I was inching forward, right? But it would not have been, well, here's the ones that I really think have a great shot here, you know? And because I had that wide portfolio of things that I could move forward on, when that opportunity presented itself, I was able to jump on that and really threw my whole strength and force behind it. And it's been, you know, it's been an incredible boost to my career, as well as being a film I'm very proud of.
Yeah, it's a nice nice calling card, something nice to hang your hat on. But yeah, Let's back up. So what was that one thing when he said, give me one of them, when you...
Actually, again, another callback. It was an Allman Brothers movie. It was a 45-minute short, 46-minute short, about one performance of one song by one band. And it's the Live at Fillmore East version of Whipping Post. And we started doing...
Is it 46 minutes long?
The finished project is going to be... The 23 minutes
is the actual song.
Is the actual song. And we go through the song twice in the course of the short. We got through 10% of making that movie and ended up saying, okay, we're going to put a pause on this. We're going to do some other things to get a little more established, then come back to this, and we've never gone back to it.
But what are the...
And now that Greg is no longer with us, I doubt we ever will.
Well, obviously, you want to tell that story in 46 minutes, you're going to tell it.
Yeah.
But what are the broad strokes of what did you want to tell in that story?
Sure. So in the first 23 minutes of the film, the song plays, And we speak with not only surviving members of the band about their memories of that night, but we also speak to other musicians who have been influenced by the Allman Brothers. And we talk to also to music journalists and music critics and even to some fans about what they hear in different parts of the song. That version of that song, it's long, but it's so densely packed. It's just, and not only musically, but also, I mean, one of my favorite things historically about that performance of that song is that, so people who are a little bit attuned to music history, most of them know that Duane Allman was arguably the second best guitar player of all time. Certainly one of the very best guitar players ever in the history of rock and roll, right? But even people who are pretty up on music who are not really deep diggers into guitarists or into Southern rock, they probably don't realize that Dickie Betts was probably in the top 10 or 15. Like sorry, Dickie, if you ever hear this, he was not at the level of Duane, but he was not far behind, right? So I love trying to get into the brain of Dickie Betts, and imagine being one of the top 10 or 15 people ever to do what you do.
Right, but the number
two guy every night
is,
you go on stage with, right? And so what I love about, one of the many things I love about that performance, that song, is that they get to the first solo. Duane does the first solo, and it's one of the greatest solos you've ever heard. It's just blistering and amazing and exploratory and jazzy and like, oh, it's just delicious, right? And then the second solo rolls around, and I just love that in my brain. I've never interviewed Dickie. I've never met Dickie, but in my brain, Dickie takes three steps forward and says, "You know what? Not tonight. Fuck this. I'm the guy tonight."
Right.
And he plays an even better solo than Duane did for that night.
Right.
For that night, the greatest guitarist in that room
was
Dickie Betts.
Right.
And so I just love that brotherly one-upsmanship. You know, it's very associated with jazz. You know, all those jazz guys were trying to one-up each other with their solos.
Right.
If you've ever seen Spike Lee's wonderful Mo Better Blues, he really captures that well in that movie. So yeah,
you know what I remember from that movie?
What's that?
It's a D-I-C-K thing.
It's a D-I-C-K thing.
Go back and watch that movie for those of you that want to historical
context. I always
context.
Remember him getting hit in the mouth with his trumpet.
Right.
Oh, it's the symbolism.
Right.
Spike. So one of Spike's heroes is Martin Scorsese.
Right.
And that moment is worthy of Scorsese and its symbolism. So the first 23 minutes, we hear the song going in the background and we hear all these people taking us deep
into
the song.
So did you get some of those interviews done?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So those are in the can somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, the song fades out, the interviews fade out, and you're a little confused because you're like, wait, I thought this was 46 minutes. Why is this over? Then the song plays again. And in this second time playing the song, there's no interview, there's no dialogue, there's no anything over it. So you're basically, there's animation. And you're basically, now that you've spent 23 minutes hearing all this dense stuff about the song, now you're just going to sit in a dark theater with 100 other people and you're just going to experience that song.
Dude, I'm smiling over here. This is nuts.
One day we'll get back to it. Maybe. I don't know. Greg's absence would be awfully, awfully big. I don't know.
Right. But there's also ways to make that part of it too.
Sure.
Right?
Sure. Yeah.
All right, where were we going there? Sorry, I'm like, yeah, I want to sit in a dark theater and hear that.
So we were talking about the Linklater movie,
right?
And then we went back to this first thing to see sort of where it, and we were there was the sort of track we were on, I think, was talking about sort of creativity and having lots of projects at once to see.
So you've got these like eight ideas you're kind of thinking about pushing forward,
right?
The Linklater movie, which is called
21 Years, Richard Linklater,
right? Yep. That one comes to fruition. How? The short version, anyway.
Yeah, short version
is like how you got to the first interview, basically.
Sure, sure. So I was sitting down with my friend Jolene Pender, who at that time was running the New Orleans Film Festival, And we were, many of these stories revolve around us drinking, about me and the other person drinking a lot. The David Clawson story did as well. But anyway, Jolene and I are drinking, and she's telling me about the upcoming New Orleans Film Festival, all the cool things they're going to do. And she said, oh, I'm really excited about this. We're going to do a 20th anniversary screening of Slacker, and Rick Linklater is going to come. And I said, oh my gosh, that's incredible. I said, that's so cool. I wish I'd known further in advance, because I could have tried to put together a cool little 5 or 10 minute, you know, kind of tribute piece to show beforehand with some interviews with actors who had worked with him. And she said, oh yeah, that would have been great. This, by the way, this is 6 weeks before the festival.
Right.
Oh, that would have been great. It's a long pause. And she said, you think you could still do that? And I said, for the festival in 6 weeks. And she said, yeah. I mean, if we weren't drinking, she probably never would have even said that, right? And I said, A, that's completely insane.
Right.
And B, let's try.
Right. Let's fucking go for it.
So I reached out to Rick's manager, and I said, hey, I want to do this thing in conjunction with this. Is this okay? You know, kind of your blessing on this. And by the way, here's my, and they said, yes, this sounds great. I said, okay, here's my wish list of people.
Right.
Can you suggest to me how I should reach out to them?
Right.
Of course, hoping that she would say, oh, let us reach out.
Right.
Instead, what she did was she just told me who each one of their agents or managers was.
Right.
Which was great, because then I was able to say, hey, agent number two, Rick's agent number one suggested I reach out to you about blank, blank, blank. Okay, this is the short version, believe it or not. The first person to respond back was Ethan Hawke's agent.
Right.
And he said, Ethan's in, anything for Rick, when do you want to do the interview?
Right.
And I kind of took a deep breath and I said, I guess I'm doing this, because even if the only interview I get is Ethan Hawke, that's worth a 10-minute short before the Rick thing, right? So then I sent an email back to all those other agents.
Said, Ethan's
and I
in.
Said, by the way, Ethan's in.
Right.
And look, I will thank Ethan Hawke from the Oscar stage one day.
Right.
Because once everybody knew Ethan was in, nobody said no. Right. Literally no one said no. There were a couple of people we couldn't get for scheduling. But so anyway, so I interviewed 6 people, 3 in New York and 3 in LA. And I put together this short, which is called A Slacker Turns 20, which was the 21 years Richard Linklater. It was basically the basic thought of that, right? And then at South By the next year, I met my eventual partner in the 21 years series, Tara Wood, who was and is a sales agent and is now a director and producer as well. And Tara, you know, I got to give Tara a lot of credit, because she really expanded my view. By that point, I was already going to make it into a feature. In fact, I was interviewing Kevin Smith that day. That's at the event I was interviewing Kevin Smith at, I met Tara, right? And, you know, but I was still planning on, look, I'm going to pretty much self-finance this. I'm going to make this for $35,000 and you know, put it out there. And she said, I think you should think bigger. I think that you should spend a couple of $100,000 on this. And I think you should get some really great animation. And I think you should really make this into a real movie. And I said, wow, that's interesting. Let's talk. We started talking. She eventually became the co-director as well as the lead producer on the project. And now the next chapter in the 21 Years series, which is 21 Years Quentin Tarantino, she's directing by herself. I'm an executive producer, but she's producing and directing that one by herself. So, and we're now struggling to try to wrest that movie back from the Weinstein Company, who bought it last year.
Oh, of all the rotten luck. Right. Well, first of all, I'm excited to hear you mention it, because I do remember that from our last interview, and I'm glad it's going to happen-ish. But I want to say that, you know, without... So first of all, go watch that movie, and without spoiling it, which, I mean, it's tough to spoil a tribute movie, I guess.
Right.
But if your aim was to make me love his work more and those actors more, that's what it did.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah, and I'm not Joe Filmophile guy. I'm like a pretty average movie guy, and I haven't seen all of them. But it made me like Ethan Hawke more. Yeah. It made me like Matthew McConaughey more, which of course, I mean, he's gold, and we can get to him in a second.
Right.
But it did make me say, "Huh, I do want to go back and see a few of these, because it has been a while, right?
Well, that's what we were trying to do. We were not making a movie for film critics.
Right.
And we were not necessarily making a movie for someone who only ever sees blockbusters.
Right.
You are our target audience
for
that film.
Okay,
people who are intelligent, not that those other people are not intelligent, but people that are intelligent connoisseurs and consumers of thinking cinema, right? And what's interesting is that when I started making this movie, if you'd asked me to name my 10 favorite directors, Rick would not have been on that list. He probably would have been in the 15 to 20 range somewhere in there. I respected him. I really liked a couple of his films, but he was not one of my guys, you know? And now he's on my Mount Rushmore.
Of course.
And I think a big part of that is doing the deep dive and spending a lot of time with his work. But I'll tell you what another part of the big part of it is. Donald Miller wrote this great book called Blue Like Jazz. And he talks about, in the prologue, he talks about how he was never a fan of jazz before. He was a rock guy. And he lives in Portland. He said, but one day I was leaving a Portland rock show and I get emotional telling this story because I love this story so much. He says, on my way to the car, I passed a guy on a street corner playing the saxophone. I stopped and listened to him. He didn't open his eyes for 20 minutes. And he said, it was at that moment that I began to love jazz. And he said in this line, I'm sure I'm going to misquote it, but it's so killer. He says, sometimes in order to fall in love with something, someone who already is in love has to show us the way.
Aww.
And that gift, now I am going to get emotional, that gift is what Matthew McConaughey gave me, and what Billy Bob Thornton gave me, and what the wonderful Julie Delpy gave me, and what all these people, and above all of them, dear, dear Ethan Hawke, gave me, is they showed me how to truly love Rick's films. And so the story, when I think of the story of 21 years, Richard Linklater, I always think of the story of my falling deeply head over heels in love with Richard Linklater's films. And they're so precious to me. And I would never, I don't know that I would ever have gone into them as deeply if not for the gift that this film was. And Ethan not only gave me that initial boost, but he was the first one to tell me, by the way, at the end of our first interview, Michael, you should make this into a feature. This would be an amazing feature. Everyone will talk to you. Everyone loves Rick. Everyone will tell you great stories. And every time I talked to Ethan, had contact with Ethan, email or whatever, he was just so encouraging. And so, I mean, he is a truly wonderful man and a true artist. Ethan Hawke is a true artist.
So before you talk to everybody, did you just deep dive, start at Slacker, and watch everything?
A bit, yeah.
You got to be careful because that'll actually pick up noise. You should know this. You're a professional.
Yes. I'm also a fidgeter.
It's okay, me too.
I didn't do it all at once. I definitely didn't do it all at once. But so there were definitely some moments in those interviews where I just had to be honest and say, yeah, I haven't seen that one. Tell me about it. You know,
right.
But obviously, before I would interview, Keanu, I can't believe I haven't even mentioned Keanu in all this because he was fantastic too. But like, you know, I had not seen A Scanner Darkly.
Me either. But I couldn't make it through it. It just wasn't my thing.
But before I interviewed Keanu, I obviously needed to see Scanner Darkly, so I saw it then.
Right.
So a lot of it happened in that way.
Right.
Oh crap! I'm interviewing Keanu.
I should probably see this movie.
I should probably see Scanner Darkly. You know.
Right.
Keanu was wonderful. Keanu invited us into his home. We did the interview in his home, and it was funny. I think it was at 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and we went over to his house. And God bless him. I think he must have gotten up 15 minutes earlier, and he was hazy. I have no idea. I'm not saying substances are hungover or anything like that. I'm just saying he obviously had not gotten a lot of sleep the night before.
Right.
And I walked in going, oh my gosh, is this interview going to be terrible?
Right. You know?
We walk into his living room, and he has this huge Ed Ruscha triptych. And I'm not hugely knowledgeable about art, but there are some artists that I love, and Ed Ruscha is one of them. And I said, oh my gosh, Ed Ruscha, right? And he says, yeah. He says, you know Ed Ruscha? And I said, oh, I love his work. He's one of my favorites. He's like, oh. So we sat and talked about Ed Ruscha for a couple of minutes.
Right.
That was the moment where Keanu, I think, kind of went,
woke up.
Okay, this right. interview could be kind of cool. This right. is, you know. Right.
Did he say, I know Kung Fu?
He did not. But if he had, it would be my ringtone on my phone.
You know, can I get you to do my ringtone?
Can I just say?
I don't think I'd seen Boyhood when we interviewed.
Dude.
Because I've since seen Boyhood, and like, where do we even begin
yeah.
on a concept and then to actually fucking do it for yeah. all of them
yeah.
to be that committed
yeah.
to never go, you know what? Fuck it. I'm done with this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's seeing that movie is one of the most deeply emotional experiences I've ever had in the cinema. And of course, part of it is that I had just spent 2.5 years doing a Richard Linklater movie.
Right.
Part of it is that I'm a father, you know. Part of it is that I'm a very nostalgic person, right? But, yeah, it didn't feel what I'd said about it at the time. It didn't feel like a movie to me. It felt like sitting down for an hour and a half and just remembering,
mm-hmm.
you know?
I think that's what it's supposed to do.
Yeah, yeah. It was just incredible. And to see, I met Eller Coltrane later. And it was so bizarre talking to him, being in front of him and talking to him, because I had to keep reminding myself, I didn't actually watch you grow up. I mean, I did, but I didn't.
Right.
Like, those things didn't actually happen to you, you know? And for him, what a strange experience for him to have, because it's not like they shot for 18 years.
Right.
They shot for, or 12 years, they shot for, you know, a few days every year.
Right. Right.
So this was just some crazy little thing he was involved in, you know, and then all of a sudden, wow, it's like.
There's my life.
It's like, I think Boyhood and Tree of Life are the greatest movies of the century so far. So
really? What's yeah. Tree of Life? Who's in that
one? It's the Terrence Malick movie with Jessica Chastain and Brad Pitt and Sean Penn.
I will watch it based on you saying those things.
It is. It's a very unusual movie, and it's not for everyone. It's really closer to like a symphony than it is to a film, I think.
Okay.
So it's parts of it are very abstract and very dreamlike, and a lot of people hate it. But I absolutely.
But that's always kind of fun, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
To like something a lot of people hate. All right. Well, I want to wrap up with some Atlanta favorites that I like to do.
Oh, sure.
Okay. Since this is the Atlanta podcast, whoa! So I want to start with what do you order when you go to the Waffle House?
Scatter, smothered, and covered is my hash brown order. I always have to have hash browns every time I go, no matter what. Sometimes it's just hash browns. Sometimes it's if I'm especially hungry. Sometimes it's a waffle and hash browns. Sometimes it's bacon and hash browns. But I'm probably gonna have boring answers to a lot of these because I tend to be kind of conventional in a lot of my
that's okay.
taste. Sometimes the obvious answer is the best answer. I think.
I think so too. All right. What is your favorite place to eat in Atlanta?
I'm gonna throw out three.
You can do that.
I am a huge fan of Homegrown, as well as being a huge fan of Kevin Clark specifically.
I think
he's amazing. I think the food is amazing.
Can you introduce me to him?
I'm sorry?
Can you introduce me to him?
Oh God, yes. Okay. Yes. Let's go to Homegrown next week and okay. I'll introduce you to him.
Great.
He is a spectacular human being, and the concept behind Homegrown, we don't have to get into it here unless you want to, but it's a spectacular concept what he's done not only in a gastronomical way, but in a community building way.
Right.
It's a really special place. So Homegrown. And then when my wife and I are going to go out for a quote unquote fancy meal, you know, we're big fans of Cakes and Ale
okay.
on the Decatur Square.
Okay.
And then I'm going to throw out a curveball. Probably my favorite place of all is the Octopus Bar in East Atlanta Village.
Now explain to people how that works. Because I've only recently learned myself.
So the Octopus Bar doesn't open until 10:30 at night.
Right.
Again, there's a concept behind it that I think is really special. It was originally founded by two guys, one of whom, Angus, has now passed away, unfortunately. Rest in peace. But these two amazing guys who came out of a fine dining background said... When they explained it to me, they said, look, we got tired of watching our servers serve this beautiful food to patrons all night long, get off at midnight, and pick up a sack of crystals on the way home because there was nothing else open.
Right.
And God bless crystal. I love a sack of crystals too. But you know, every night for your dinner is not exactly. not what you deserve, honestly, right. after what you've done that night,
right.
bringing these incredible food experiences to people. So they originally started the Octopus Bar, and I'm sure I'm going to get some things wrong here, but this part is not wrong, as a place primarily for servers. And they didn't advertise. They didn't put a sign up. They did nothing. They just opened this place. It was going to open at 10:30 that had just exquisitely curated food and prepared food, an amazingly artisanal cocktail service, and a wonderfully curated beer list. They only have 4 beers every time you go, but there's always one that I want. So it started out just as servers, just a place for servers to go, and then eventually the word kind of got out a little bit. But the thing is, for a restaurant as well as for any organization, for a coffee house, for a church, for a whatever, the atmosphere of the place acquires a certain momentum, so that if you walk in and you're I'm going to try not to be very specific about any of these people, but if you're a kind of douchey guy.
Right.
Who wants to go in and be loud, and you don't really care about the food or the drink, and you're there to see if you can get laid, or you're there to raise hell with your buddies or whatever. And look, I mean, God bless those kind of people. I've had those kind of nights too, right? But you're going to walk into the Octopus Bar, you're going to maybe stay for one drink, and you're going to be like, this place sucks. Let's go right. Let's go out somewhere else, right?
Right.
So you're never going to go back to the Octopus Bar. So it's a self-selecting process to where now, even though it's no longer all or even primarily servers that go there, the people that choose to go there do have a certain – it feels – if you've ever been a server before, you know there's usually a bar, if not a restaurant, at least a bar that you go to after your shift where everybody in the city congregates, right?
Right.
So it still kind of feels that way, even though it's not that precisely anymore.
Right.
It still kind of feels that way.
Right.
Plus their music is phenomenal. It's yeah. generally old school funk and old school hip hop.
Well, you know, this place, so this co-working space is very self-selecting like that. You don't yeah. walk in here if you're a guy that's going to be a loud sales guy on the phone every day.
Sure.
You don't walk in here and go, this seems like a good place to put up shop.
Right, right.
So it tends to attract some pretty cool people and from yeah. all different kinds of, there's therapists, there's accountants, there's film people. Like this is a very, you know, I do fucking obstacle stuff and podcasts. Like it's a very eclectic kind of cool group.
By the way, I'm also going to throw in the Brick Store. You should also have those guys on the podcast.
Anybody you can introduce me to after this is over, I'm yep. down for. What is your favorite Atlanta festival?
My favorite Atlanta festival. I mean, God, I mean, you know, of course, I'm partial to the Atlanta Film Festival, of course. Boy, there's an interesting history there.
I think we talked about that last time,
yeah.
but we won't have to go into it this time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Non-film festival.
Non-film festival. I don't know. That's a good question.
I don't know. You can text me later.
I might have to think about that and give you an answer later.
All right. So here's one that you can't get wrong okay. or that you can't answer. I don't know. You got to rate these in order. Okay?
Sure. Sure.
Falcons to you. Rank these in importance of you.
Sure.
Falcons, Braves, United.
Historically or at the moment?
Let's go both.
Okay. So over the course of my life, it would go. Let me say, first of all, that I have not, although I'm a huge soccer fan.
You've got a lot of, what do you call it?
Qualifiers. Yeah, yeah, I'm a big qualifier. I'm a huge soccer fan. I've played soccer all my life. I've coached soccer. I'm a big Arsenal fan. I have, not intentionally, but I just have, just as it happens, the way the last year has gone, I haven't been on the Atlanta United train yet. All of my friends have. I know once I start, it's going to be a deep dive, and I'm going to be hugely committed to them, but not yet. So they're number three in both lists. Over the course of my life, it goes Braves, Falcons, United. But currently, I'm much more engaged. Well, both Braves and Falcons, but probably Falcons edged them out a little bit, especially over with the last couple of months with right. what's been happening with the Braves.
Yeah. Well, believe it or not, surprisingly to me, United has been up there for many, many people.
Yeah.
It appears yeah. to be the sport for the young people.
Sure. Sure. Well, and you know, it's got the best attendance in the whole league.
Right.
You know,
I'm super, I've talked about this a lot, so I won't get into it too much, but I'm super skeptical. It feels very of the moment. It feels very the fad. It feels very hipster thing to do.
Yeah.
So we're going to see, you know, we've got a new stadium. That's very sexy. Over time, we'll see if soccer sticks around.
Yeah. Yeah, have you enjoyed going to games? Have you
been to games? I've not been to a game.
Yeah,
I've invited people to take me to games so I can do the open minded. Let me experience it and see what it's like.
Sure,
but I'm very old school, dude. So I'm very like I have super fond memories of Atlanta Fulton County with both teams.
Sure,
I was at there's I've never said this before. There was a famous Billy White's Shoes Johnson last second pass, and I was at that game.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I was there. Dude, I don't realize this now that I've never said this before. I was there when Sid Bream came home in 94.
No.
It was the year before we won the series.
Yeah,
we
yeah.
went, but we didn't win.
Right.
Oh, yeah, I was at that game.
Francisco Cabrera.
Francisco Cabrera.
Wow.
Yeah, man.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I will, of course, that's like our when Kennedy was shot. No one in Georgia will ever forget where they were when
I
that
should
happened.
Talk. I should start. Maybe I might not make a question. If somebody's over the age of like 35, where were you? Remember, there was actually a billboard that said, "Where were you in when Bream came home?" or "Where were you when Sid came
yes,
home?"
Yes.
What's his name? I think it's Glavin or Smoltz. Is one of those awesome, like 10 best moments things. He said he was so excited. He was like, "Oh my god, we got a hit!" And then he looked up again and, "Oh no, it's Sid!" Like the slowest, the most awkward, slowest guy, right?
Yeah, the longest run from third to home. You know, not only was it actually long in actual time, but for every Braves fan,
took
a week for him to get from third to home.
Right. All right. I think that's a good note to end on.
Absolutely.
And I was honestly, I was a little nervous. I was like, oh, we kind of did this once, but I think I'm AD like you. I remember nothing.
Sure.
From 2 years ago. So.
No, it didn't feel it didn't feel like we were going over the same ground at all, although we might have. I don't know.
All right. Well, this one's way better.
I love it.
All right. Good.
Thanks
talking.
For having me, man.
Sure, dude. All right, there you have it, folks. Tell a friend about this brand new podcast that you found called the Atlanta Podcast. Tell a friend. Enjoy the rest of your holiday week, although you're probably going to hear from me again. Love you, miss you, mean it. I have got to run.